Ouais, c'est bon.
It's a real pleasure to have today our friend Yari Davidson. Yari graduated in Bologna some years ago, working with Nicole Bolzonella, one of the author of the first course working with photometric redshift, right? Then he did a first postdoc here at LAM some years ago. He moved to EPAC in California for a couple of years, maybe three, if I remember correctly. And then now he is a fellow at the Cosmic Down Center in Copenhagen, University of Copenhagen. So please, Yari, you can start and invite everyone to ask questions at any time. Feel free to open your webcam. And it's much more nice. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlo. And not only questions, I was trying to make it a bit more interactive, let's say. And so when we talk about these epistemological, maybe it's a big word, issues like reproduce results from another piece of work and these kind of things, I also wanted to hear from you, or at least to see where the audience stand. So I know you have a virtual hand in Zoom, and so I would just like to start asking you to raise your virtual hand if this situation that is written here in the blue box, you can relate with it. That you or somebody working with you, like, hi, Tipo, I didn't know. Yeah, I see. Okay, so I'm not the only one who was navigating through these kind of troubles. And let's see about this one, which is basically, I can read it louder. Without new data or improved techniques, I don't think that makes much sense to write a paper showing some result that has already been published. Okay, so no old school people thinking about. And then the third one is more tricky, and it's about how you try to reproduce your own maybe preliminary result. If you have a specific procedure or you just improvise. Okay, don't see many hands over here. And I think this is one of the most interesting things I wanted to talk today, and the one that is connected to this Cosmos 2020 Galaxy Catalog that we recently released. But Cosmos 2020, can you see my cursor? I guess so. The Cosmos 2020 is not the only thing I want to talk today. I would like to discuss a little bit the issue of reproducing science, open science, and also, I mean, I have to do this commercial break. Maybe I will start with a commercial break. But first, let me thank these three people who basically inspired me to look into these things and prepare this talk. Okay, so let's start with the advertisement. It's nice to do this here in virtually here in Marseille, because something like 3 years ago, 2019, there was another cafe club, and I was presenting this paper, which is now published, about the self-organizing maps, which is basically a non-supervised machine learning method taking galaxies, which are these, I mean, you can use whatever objects you want. In our case, we used a sample of galaxies whose features were observer frame colors. So in this example, it's just color one, color two, and color three, but it's really a multidimensional technique that can be applied with a much larger number of feature, a much larger number of colors. And then there is an adaptive process, and here is when the machine learning kicks in, that adapts this network of cells, we call it, because they look like cells, but actually they are just neurons, like in any other neural network. Adapt this grid to the parameter space of the galaxies. And so what you obtain when you kind of iron, when you flat this grid, and this is what you see on the right, is a dimensionality reduction of the initial multidimensional data set. And the nice thing is that the object, now it changed, I used a color code according, I think, to the ratio, but it's not very important. The point is that galaxies that are in the same cells share similar properties. And one possibility that you have is to calibrate this method in order to measure physical parameters for these galaxies, stellar mass, or in this case, star formation rate. And what they showed back then in 2019 was that the method was working pretty well with simulated galaxies. So we got this mock galaxy catalog from Horizon AGN, and the comparison between the true star formation rate from the simulation and the measurement that we got from the self-organizing map was in pretty good agreement. And the news is that now we apply the same technique to real data from this Cosmos 2020 catalog I'm going to present later on. And it's nice to see that also in the real universe, this method works pretty well. So we got a nice agreement between the SFR from the SOM and some other independent estimate based on far infrared data. And most important thing, classical approaches like SCD fitting using the same input data as the SOM were not performing as well. So it's not only that the method works, it's also better than other available options. Anyway, now that I finished the advertisement part, I'd like to start discussing this issue of reproducing previous results. And why did I look into it? Why do I want to talk about that? I don't know. It's just that at some point I stumbled in this Nature article presenting a survey. So Nature interviewed something like 1,500 scientists from different fields, asking them, do you think there is a serious issue in reproducing previous results? What are the possible reasons for that? And I found it quite interesting. I mean, not a lot of astrophysicists in the pool of interviewed people. And also the other papers that were cited in this Nature paper were more about biological or medical sciences. So I can imagine it's more difficult to reproduce an experiment in that cases. But still, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think it should be asked also, and it has been asked also in our field. And when we think about do we trust published results have been reproduced by someone else? Is it a reasonable level of reliable science what we have nowadays? Immediately, one thinks about the relatively, I mean, let's say non-negligible number of Nature papers that have been either proved to be wrong or relatively questionable. And I'm not going to start the list of all the cases that can come up in my mind, the phosphine things and all these things, but there is one specific example that I would like to highlight because it involves also some of my colleagues at the Cosmic Dawn Center. So basically, this was, well, a Nature astronomy paper by Zhang et al. They were taking some spectra with Keck. You see the different exposure here. At some point, there was one frame where this flash popped up. It's you see the wavelength is in the observer frame near infrared, but the galaxies they were studying has a photometric redshift of almost 11. So they assume this is a U rest frame UV flash from a gamma ray burst happening from that galaxy. Well, a bunch of other authors looked into that, and I don't know how this ended, but I think there is a almost global consensus that this was a coincidence, a glare from debris orbitating around the Earth, just illuminated by the sun, and by chance it was on the same line of sight of this galaxy. They decided to start some construction work outside. I hope you don't hear any noise. Let me know otherwise. Now, it's a half full, half empty glass situation, I would say, because this bunch of published paper that after some careful independent check turned out to be questionable. Well, this may be a signal that people are probably too quick in jump to conclusion, maybe try to make the results very outstanding and extreme, and maybe the peer review process is not working in the best possible way. And this is basically summarized in this Nature editorial article that I don't think I have time to show you. But on the other side, I like to see the half full glass and say that nature is actually a good example of how science should work, in the sense that it's the journal is unparalleled, let's say, for how open it is in terms of releasing all the data in a very clear way, releasing the software, not only the data, so also the code the authors use to produce the results. And second point is there are big incentives to double check a Nature paper. So many other teams would like to replicate the analysis, because if you find some mistake, or I mean, if you see something else that the original team didn't find, well, you get a lot of visibility. So there are these two elements, the open data, the open science thing, and the incentives. And so starting with the open data, what's the situation besides nature? Well, Monthly Notices is doing some significant improvement in that regard. So it's been almost 2 years. This summer it could be 2 years since they decided to add a compulsory section at the end of every paper, where the authors have to explain how people can get their data. And this is the data availability statement section. The interesting thing is, though, in the MRS website, they offer some example of statement that you can that you can use in your paper. From, I don't know, having the URL and links to things, to a very, well, let's say a not very open statement, where basically the authors just write, okay, we have the data, and upon reasonable request, we can send them to you, which is okay, but not that much. And I think it tells something, the fact that for the paper I could check, almost half of them rely on this vague statement of, okay, send us an email and we will see if your request is reasonable, we will see what we can do for you. Ideally, what everyone should aim at is to make their body of work findable, accessible, which is not the same thing, because you can find a website where the data are, but you can have big troubles extracting those data from the website. Interoperable, so that you can use them also for other projects. You can use them also if you doesn't speak Python, but there is an easy way to translate them into another framework, and reusable in the sense that you are allowed to use them for other projects. And there are a lot of incentives to go fair, not only in nature, but for example, if you hold a grant from the European Research Council, now they really expect you to make all your results fair. And the funny thing is, there are these automatic evaluators. I just put here the, maybe I should, maybe if we have time during the discussion to check some paper on one of these websites, you just put the DOI or the URL to the paper, and the evaluator automatically finds or tries to find if there is some critical issue with respect to this fair approach. For example, I don't know, in this example, there was a problem because the data were online, but in a non-permanent website. So not in a URL system that is guaranteed to last for several years. And the other thing I was talking about, along with open science, is the incentives to reproduce data, to reproduce previous results. And this is more, well, okay. This is where sometimes I get in trouble when I give this talk. So not for the plot on the left. The plot on the left, I mean, it's old story. And honestly, I don't even remember exactly. My point here is that relatively often we have an incentive not to dig into possible problems of previous papers. I mean, we may have an incentive to reproduce the analysis, but at the same time, we also have, for example, an unconscious bias to succeed in reproduce those results. So this is a historical perspective. It was some fundamental particle transition. I completely forgot what this was about. Anyway, they got this, I don't know, synchrotron stuff. They measure some parameter, and of course there was the seminal paper with a given number for the result and a large error bar, and then other labs tried to reproduce the experiment, and they succeeded. I mean, they succeeded extremely well, with smaller error bars, because in the meantime they improved the equipment, the facilities, and stuff like this. So all the literature was in agreement, but unfortunately there was some sort of some error they made in the first experiment that was corrected only by this paper after 1973. And then magically everybody else reproducing the experiment found the updated value for this eta plus minus transition thing. So it's kind of complicated when we talk about incentives, because obviously we talk about, I mean, we are not rational beings, we are humans, we have fears, emotion, and there is a psychological side that must be taken into account. And here on the right, I was a bit provocative, and I put also, I wanted to make a big shout out to Olivier Kaufman and Olivier Hilbert, who worked very hard there at LAM to produce our own UV luminosity function with this Cosmos 2020 data. But the point is, you look to all these different studies and say, oh, that's great. They are confirming the shape of the luminosity function. And then you say, okay, but is it true, or is it really some psychological bias? So the bandwagon bias, also called, that everybody wants to be in agreement with everybody else. And another psychological problem, it's even political probably problem we have, is that when the opposite happens, so when two different teams find a disagreement, we are not always able to discuss this disagreement in the more appropriate way. And other incentives I invite you to think about may come from other fields, for example, computer science. So what they're doing these days is, example A, give priority in conferences to, you know, when you have contributed talks and people are submitting their abstracts and they are ranked to assign the slots, give some extra point to abstracts presenting a work that satisfies certain reproducibility criteria. For example, a work that is more fair, findable, accessible, and so on, than the average. And also, well, this is not only computer science, but it's also very popular in particle physics, have some kind of competition, luring people, inviting people to verify some trend, some feature in a data set, everyone with their own approach, with their own techniques, and with some prize, some award, some recognition at stake. So people are more motivated to do this dirty job of finding something that is not new, but just reproduce already published stuff. And I think my 25 minutes ended. So last part of my talk is just to show what we try to do in the Cosmos 2020 case. And basically this is the explanation everybody was waiting for about why the Cosmos 2020 Galaxy Photometric Catalog is published in a paper that is 2022. So I don't think I need to explain to this audience what is the Cosmos extragalactic field and why we wanted to make a catalog combining photometry from different telescopes. I just want to emphasize that we started this project September 2018, confident to finish everything in 2 years. It takes double the time, so we released the catalog in 2022, and but we decided to stay with the name because the data we used were updated up to 2020. So there is in this catalog we haven't used images or new data that are more recent than 2020. And so what happened in the extra 2 years, let's say? Well, a lot of testing. So instead of waiting for some independent team testing everything later on, we did all this careful job by ourselves. There was this unusual decision to release four different versions of the catalog. So we did the photometric extraction from the telescope images twice with two independent approaches. And then for each photometric catalog, we measured the redshift and all these galaxy properties in two alternative ways. So two by two is four different flavors for this Cosmos 2020 catalog. This implies some redundancy. So you see, for example, there is the name in the outer list of Olivier Albert, who is, I mean, you know, he's one of the maximum expert in photometric redshift and SED fitting. But we also have Gabe Brammer, who is definitely in the same league. So there is, we have John Weaver working on one photometric code, Olivia Kaufman worked on the other one. So there was this redundancy that helped us to validate. Actually, I think the next slide is a better summary of this. Yes. So there was this interlab validation where people in Marseille or in Paris were doing some work, and then they would send us to us in Copenhagen the result, and we were testing them, and vice versa. And this explained the idea of having multiple experts, even though it may look like a duplication. We got in touch with, I don't know, for example, for the hyper supreme cam data from the Subaru telescope, we got in touch with our Japanese colleagues and do another independent validation between our results and their results in the part of the sky where the two things were overlapping. If you are in Euclid, you have this garage day slang, but anyway, we organize workshops where we didn't give talks or stuff. We just sit down and debug each other codes and try to be sure we were on the right track. And it was at the end this almost 2 years delay. And it's interesting when you compare all these things we implemented, they are in very consistent with the, you remember the nature survey I mentioned at the beginning. So all these actions are also discussed in that survey. So it's interesting to see the approach we had in mind and all these other 1500 scientists had in mind. And of course, if we are talking about open science, at the end of this journey, we released everything and even more. So we created additional Jupyter notebooks, which are linked from the archive page of the paper. We created additional notebooks, especially for the general users. So they can download the catalog and learn how to use it in the right way and in the shortest possible time. And well, it's working in the sense that the number of unique downloads is the number. I mean, the numbers are pretty nice, and they are ramping up. And we will see, hopefully soon, if all the implementations, all the improvement we did compared to the previous Cosmos catalog in terms of accessibility and testing and validation of the results, we will see if they will pay out. And I think this is it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Yari, for your very unusual talk, highlighting some strange, well, unusual question. Any comment or question, both on science and or epistemology?
Yeah, comments are also very welcome. So,
can you comment about the fact that the answer that question on the last slide, what factors could boost reproducibility? The most likely is better understanding of statistics. Even though the difference is not so large. Right?
Yeah, I
also how many people answered to this?
This is 1,500 scientists, but it's from. I mean, it's difficult to make a take-at-home message for astrophysicists because I mean I don't know. I haven't read many Lancet papers, for example, in my life, but a few of them, yes, and. Without any strong background in statistics, because I wouldn't say I'm a statistic buff, it was pretty obvious there were some weak links in their statistical analysis. And, well, so maybe this answer came mostly from people doing that kind of research. I don't know. But if there is somebody here in the audience who has the feeling that also in astrophysics, our understanding of statistics is not great and this can make some problem, and just raise your hand. And hi, Thibault.
Hi. Very nice talk, first of all. I think it's very interesting to address these kind of issues and to look at ourselves and our biases. And that's exactly what I want to stress. I mean, I would say that for people doing statistics, astrophysics, first of all, we try, as you did for and very thoroughly, we try to reduce the biases ourselves, so to have cross checks and to at least to report any source of bias we may have, and which might affect our analysis. But then it's also it's very easy to, for example, to miss some information about the samples we are using when you describe your own results. Of course, you know very well your sample, and sometimes you forget to say some information that should be given for the people to reproduce correctly your analysis. So it's very easy to bias the reproducibility.
Yeah, that's true.
Even if you have the best intention, it's very easy So that's just something we have. I think the way you proceed with the extra, I mean, it's kind of not proofreading, but before that, some independent team or independent people looking at your analysis before you see what I mean?
And yeah, absolutely.
I think that the only way to really provide all the information required for other teams to reproduce your results. So that's a very nice that's a very nice tip.
Yeah, proposition. And to add some detail about that, we actually did something like that when I mentioned software for the general audience for users to start using our catalog, we had beta testers. So we had a few master students. We gave them the catalog before the public release. So and asked them to reproduce some of the results of the plots the figures of the draft. At that point, the paper was a draft. And then little by little, we realized, okay, we haven't, they failed several times. Okay, this student is not able to reproduce this figure because we forgot to mention this important parameter or this aspect or this other caveat. And so little by little, I hope we improved a lot the accessibility and the clarity of the data set in this way. And for the independent validation that you mentioned, I mean, you're 100% right. And for example, something that is not that well, I'm not reading archive every day these days, but there are several machine learning papers in Astro, which may have received a big help. I mean, which may have turned out to be much better than what they actually are, if the authors reached out somebody from for example the computer science department of their institute, just not to some door of something with a deeper understanding of statistics, as we were talking about, and just ask their opinion about the study and see if there is something that can be done better.
May I comment on a point? The cross-check interlab is a possible way to reduce the bias. Now, for some domain, a very fancy domain of astrophysics, that it risks to be impossible in the future. Think about the very huge collaboration. Think about Euclid, okay, which involves thousands of people or working on a specific topic, dark energy, okay, just to make a sense. And the competitor is another big collaboration, DESI, okay, with hundreds of collaborations, and roughly all the scientists in the world are in one of the two, okay, apart from few exceptions, and with some overlap also sometimes. Do you think there's the risk? Well, what's your comment about the risk to be strongly biased and be impeded to have a new discovery and to pick out the real biases? That's in some way. I remind the very provocative paper written in 2006 by Simon White: "Why dark energy is bad for astronomy." Well, he was pointing toward about dark energy as a topic that involves very huge collaborations, unlike in particle physics. Okay, in the huge collaboration, you can have, of course, an internal cross check. Okay, very, very easy. But at some point, you have to publish, and all the list of authors are supposed to agree with the result. And you have a thousand of people that agree on the results. Who is able to prove or disprove it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this apocalyptic scenario will happen. Maybe a bunch of people will stay away from both collaborations and they will be able to. But it's definitely, even if we consider this like an hypothetical catastrophic scenario, it touch, I think, a nerve, which is the peer review process, which I didn't discuss here, which is one of the things in that Jean Conrad commentary I linked in my slides. I mean, first of all, peer review is not, I mean, it's not the wheel. I mean, I don't know, it's something that started to be systematically implemented only relatively recently, I think in the 70s, maybe even in the 80s. I'm not sure about, don't quote me about this. But I mean, Einstein, I mean, in the Hubble, the beginning of the 20th century, it's not that every paper was sent out to a referee, and the editor was deciding by themselves. And I don't know, maybe will we get back to that situation at some point?
Let me remind it, until the 80s, there was one volume of a review per year. Now we have more than one.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I mean, I'm joking, but only half joking, in the sense that if the editor receives a Euclid paper, I'm familiar with the Euclid system, Euclid paper with, I don't know, 85 authors, which supposedly at least read the paper. So plus an internal revision process, all these things. I mean, the temptation to accept the paper without sending it to another referee is strong. Well, I mean, probably it will never happen. But also my point is this refereeing system that started to work full steam 50 years ago or something. I mean, you can't expect to be to stay the same forever, right? So maybe there will be something new at some point. Maybe there will be professional referees, like people paid to check, to really check the analysis, not just to read the paper and make some minor comments. I don't know. This might be a solution to the problem you were discussing.
Apart from the referee process, as for science, the scientific goal, you have a lot of people working on the same topic and agreeing on the topic. Is there room for other labs to work on the same topic? And if yes, how many of a different lab will work on the same topic? Same collaboration, not lab. Not so many. So the hope to have a one sigma disagreement, as in the plot you've shown before and after the 1973, risk to be reduced, no?
Yeah, but that, I mean, then there are also, I mean, the economics and the job market considerations. So I don't know. I don't really have an answer to that, but I think the situation has to change quite radically in the near future, because otherwise, I mean, it's difficult to see the status quo, the present situation lasting much longer with all these big changes right around the corner.
Any question on the science from the audience or comment?
The science really had to, because otherwise it would stop paying me. But I just wanted to.
No raised hand, no message in the chat. Okay. So
good with me. It's almost noon.
If not, thank you, Yari, again. We can stop here this seminar
and advertise next.